Welcome to EJB Talks, Rutgers Blaustein School experts in policy, planning, and health, where we talk with our faculty and staff experts, as well as students, about how the fields of public policy, urban planning, public health, health administration, and public and urban informatics affect your lives. Welcome to EJB Talks. I'm Stuart Shapiro, the Interim Dean of the Blaustein School, and the purpose of this podcast is to highlight the work my colleagues, our alumni, and today our students in the fields of policy, planning, and health are doing to make the world, the country, and New Jersey a better place. Today we're taking a break from this season's theme of talking to representatives of the centers at Blaustein School to focus on the story that everyone is thinking and talking about: the Russian invasion of Ukraine. My guest today is a Blaustein doctoral student from Russia, Sergei Kostev. Thanks for appearing on the podcast, Sergei.
Hello, good evening, afternoon.
Who knows when people will be listening to this, so it could be any time of day. Let's start by getting to know you. Can you talk a little bit about what made you decide to come to the United States to study?
In 22 years ago, I was studying a curious topic. I was comparing political cultures of Soviet and Nazi elites, and I published like a student paper or something. And then I encountered a problem of getting data sources on this topic. And then here I see advertisement from a State Department on various exchange programs, like Fulbright program, undergraduate exchange program, et cetera, et cetera. So I applied six times to different programs, and 6 or 7 years later, I got my Fulbright grant to study at Georgetown in 2007, I think. So there I studied how United States interest groups try to influence budget appropriations in United States Congress. And then since Russia has become more belligerent on the international arena, and since I'm studying interest groups for the most part, I started studying and publishing on Russian lobbying in the United States. And after that, I started following U.S.-Russia relations, not only as a citizen, but more professionally. So weirdly, some of my interests started from interest group studies, and now I'm following very closely U.S.-Russia relations for all the bad reasons.
Right. Well, obviously many of us have become, amateur followers of U.S.-Russia relations and Russia in particular, but maybe you can give us a more firsthand account of the Putin regime, which has really covered the last 20 plus years now. How has life in Russia changed under Putin?
In 2000, he made very important changes in the Russian system. First, he took control over major national networks. It happened 22 years ago. Later, this censorship increased, and he started controlling major business media like Kommersant, Vedomosti. I have been published in all of them. So gradually, his control over Russian media moved even from networks to even newspapers and now websites. This one part. Another part are gradual changes in political system. Important body in Russian government system is Council of Federation. It's like U.S. Senate. And initially, in 1990s, governors and head of state legislatures have been members of this Federation Council. So it was very important body because very important people sat on that council. They blocked multiple proposals for reforms from, let's say, Boris Yeltsin. So what Putin did, he just removed all those people. He changed constitution. And he removed all those powerful people from Russian Senate. And now it just people appointed. They are not representative of anybody. So these were very important decisions. And later, after Beslan tragedy, maybe some of you heard it in Beslan, several hundred children have been killed. He made a very strange decision, he said, to better control, to prevent terrorism, governors have to be appointed by me. Later, he reversed that decision, but still now, all aspects of Russian political system gradually, it didn't happen overnight, are controlled by the Putin. And then he started removing all the opposition forces. Boris Nemtsov, he was a vice chair of Russian government in 1990s under Yeltsin. He was murdered by the Kremlin walls within like few yards of the Kremlin. And then we have poisoning of Alexei Navalny. He was presidential contender in 2018. So when you see like a few Russians who demonstrate against the war now in St. Petersburg, Novosibirsk, my hometown, those are extremely courageous people because they could face severe penalties for doing so.
Yeah, the steps you outline and given sort of your interests, it seems like it's straight out of the totalitarian textbook, if you will.
Yeah.
Eliminate media, eliminate opposition, eliminate any other centers of power that can contest your power. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. But it happened very slowly. So initially when oil prices have been high for like most of the 2000s, Russian people just didn't care because democracy, sorry guys, it's not in Russian DNA. So people just didn't care. But then oil prices started decreasing. He annexed Crimea to increase his popularity because in Russian minds, Crimea, it's like a place where you go for vacation. So everybody in Russia loved to have Crimea back since it was like Russian for the most part of the Russian history. So everybody loved it. But then he started this war with Ukraine in Donbass. It was very limited for the like 8 years. But now he decided to escalate. People wonder why this happened. Some people say because of the COVID, he has been isolated. And if previously people who are in charge of economy, like central bankers, treasury secretaries, people like that, they had unfettered access to President Putin. So they can be able to counterbalance a little bit, all those generals and those like defense secretaries, KGB people, etc. But during the COVID, economic people lost permanent access to Putin, but military people continue to enjoy unfettered access. So I guess this is why his mindset changed over the last 2 years, and this is why he is behaving so recklessly.
Right, right. And it does indeed seem reckless. It seems like a lot of harm is going to come to Russia one way or another as a result of this. And so there is an element of recklessness that one does not associate with someone who's been very cold and calculating in all of those small steps you talked about earlier.
Yeah. And the biggest sanction came today when U.S. Treasury announced that it's blocking accounts of Russian Central Bank in the United States. But most importantly, and this is where Putin miscalculated horribly, as most dictators do because they're limited in their information, Biden was able to create a huge coalition. He was able to have Europe on the board. He was able to have Canada on the board. He was able to have Japan on the board. So basically the whole world blocked Russian central banking system. And now Russian currency is in free fall. Russian markets are in free fall. There will be hyperinflation in Russia in the coming months and years. So this was a reckless decision by the Putin to invade Ukraine. And I guess the reason was that he thought Germans, they like Russian gas, and now they have like different prime minister. Maybe he's not very strong. And also they have a history with Germans, like Chancellor one of the chancellors in Germany. He's currently head of the Rosneft, Russian oil company. So maybe he thought, oh, I gave some bribes to some Germans and they won't block this Nord Stream pipeline. They won't join this sanctions on Russian central bank. So he made a huge miscalculation, which is costing Russian people dearly.
So you mentioned the protests in Russia, and indeed I agree. Obviously, anyone participating in them is showing tremendous courage. Do you think there's any chance they will make a difference in Russia, or is the state so powerful and the number of dissenters small enough that that it's great to see, but it's not going to make much of a difference?
It will make a difference eventually, because when you have hyperinflation, it means your security forces, which have been enjoying higher standards of living than like other people who are working in our retail, right? But when those people see their salaries evaporate like day by day, I think his grip on Russian security forces will dissipate, and those protests will make a difference eventually.
Because they'll become bigger due to the economic suffering.
Yes, and Russian security forces won't be so eager to beat them and put them in jail because their own salaries are evaporating.
I see. Gotcha. So you mentioned a few things that we've done already. Is there more stuff that the Biden administration and Western policy in general should be doing?
One thing what they can do, they can gradually reduce purchases of Russian oil and gas. It would be painful for Europe mostly. So Biden administration, I guess, have to invest some resources to offset it. It can be done overnight, but a gradual decrease in purchases of Russian oil and gas will put even more pressure on Putin, and he will have to retreat. Or maybe there will be a regime change because like two-thirds of dictators are removed by the coup.
Right. Well, there's always that possibility. You know, I know a lot of people listening to this see the, you know, horrible images coming out of Ukraine, and they're going to get worse in the weeks and months ahead, I suspect, and wonder if there's anything they can do. Is there anything individual people can do here in this country?
I guess lots of international organizations are now trying to provide all kind of humanitarian assistance. So if you have some $5 where you can chip in for some international organization which providing some humanitarian assistance to Ukrainians, like providing some medicine, providing some shelter and stuff. Maybe organizations in Poland which are now helping Ukrainian refugees. You can find probably an organization which is helping Ukrainian refugees in Poland right now.
Yeah, it so happened. I wrote a few down in case people listening do want to make contributions, because as we think about the geopolitical implications and the reasons this is happening, we can really never forget that people are dying and being displaced. As you mentioned, the refugee flows are considerable. A few places you can focus on are the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, UCCA, United Help Ukraine, and Nova Ukraine. I'm sure if you Google, you can find other ones, but those are ones that have come to my attention. Sergey, any final thoughts before we let you go?
I feel extremely distressed because I have a friend, Alexander Tsaruk. He's a PhD student at West Virginia University, and currently his parents are now under attack in central Ukraine. So this is extremely personal and sensitive situation for me. My mom, she will suffer from hyperinflation, but his parents are hearing Russian gunfire.
Yeah, that's a hell of a way to end it. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your perspective with us today, Sergey.
Thanks.
A big thank you as well, as always, to Amy Cobb and Karen Olson. We're going to try and do hopefully at least one more podcast on this subject in the next day or two as events continue to develop. And we will see you then. Until then, no matter where you are, stay safe.